in Portland. Paint and Struggle, Muralism and Radical Politics in Chile is an evening that will feature a short documentary film and a conversation about the collaboration between students and organized labor in the struggle for free higher education in Chile. Again, that's Paint and Struggle, Muralism and Radical Politics in Chile, Wednesday, October 4th at 7 p.m. at People's Co-op, 3029 Southeast 21st Avenue in Portland. More information is available at kboo.fm on the right-hand side of the homepage under Community Events.
What does it mean to be called crazy in a crazy world? Listen to Madness Radio, Voices and Visions from Outside Mental Health. Sponsored by the Icarus Project and Portland Hearing Voices, Madness Radio can be heard on KBOO-FM, the Pacifica Network, and online at madnessradio.net. Welcome to Madness Radio. This is your host, Will Hall. Today, my guest is Gogo Ekaya Esima. Gogo Ekaya is a traditional healer, a teacher, and a psychiatric survivor. She's a shaman in the Sangoma tradition of South Africa with a private practice based in Southern California. So welcome to Madness Radio, Gogo Ekaya Esima.
Thank you. It's such a blessing to be here. Thanks for inviting me.
It's been great to meet you through the Crazy Wise film that we're both a part of, and we were recently in the Crazy Wise town hall, and people can check out Crazy Wise on the internet. And the topic is, I think, of great interest to listeners, the idea that what gets called a psychiatric crisis or a mental illness might actually be the signs of initiation into being a shaman or a traditional healer, having some kind of positive role to play as a healer and teacher in the community. So I'm really interested to have you on the show. And I should also mention that Madness Radio is now a affiliate radio show of Mad in America Radio. So thanks to Mad in America for sponsoring us. So maybe we should just get started. Tell us how you got involved in all this. How did you first start having mental health problems? And then how did that evolve into your discovery of your calling and your vocation as a healer?
Sure. I suffered from depression for most of my life, through childhood on through adulthood. And a lot of that was suppressed in my family. And so it really wasn't addressed. And then about when I was in my early 30s, I started to see things that other people didn't see and have some auditory interruptions as well. And at that time, I felt like my whole world was crashing in front of me. So I attempted suicide several times. And the last time that that happened, I woke up in the hospital room and realized that I was still alive. And from that point on, I decided to start looking for my purpose in life, because apparently someone, something, some energy wanted me to remain here.
So when you say depression, you suffered with this your whole life. What kind of depression was it, or how did it sort of affect you?
Yeah, depression affected me. I mean, I think they diagnosed me with major depressive disorder. It affected me in the way where I was in and out of work a lot. Like, there's some points of in my life where I couldn't wake up and actually get up to go to work. So it was hard for me to keep employment. I lost contact with my children, which further deepened my depression. And then not dealing with some trauma that I experienced through my childhood, through sexual abuse and that sort of thing, really was just pressing down on me as I became older. And yeah, I just had to do something about it.
And this was something that was connected with your own trauma experiences, your own abuse experiences that weren't dealt with.
Yeah, they weren't dealt with. I mean, I believe my family did, as you know, my mom did as much as she could at the time with her experience. But after she did what she could, everything was swept under the rug, like I was just supposed to forget about everything and move on with my life. And the abuser was still in my life, still able to see me. So it was just really strange. And I didn't know who to trust in life, and was, you know, even had symptoms or issues of paranoia where I would get around people or, and have really intense social anxiety as well, and feel like that I couldn't trust anyone around me.
So your abuser was still in your life. So this was an ongoing threat, really, that you were experiencing. So the depression, it sounds like, was really related to this situation of violence and kind of powerlessness, of being not being able to really get safety in your life.
Yeah,
something
definitely
like that.
Not to get not feeling safe and not being able to vocalize my truth. I think that was the big part of like my experiences, is not having the ability to communicate in the way that was healing for myself.
So you weren't able to challenge or confront this abuser or speak what your truth
right,
was.
Right, not until way later.
And so then you carry this kind of depression that wasn't dealt with, and it sounds like it really came to a culmination with really extreme states. You said you started to see things and have experiences that other people weren't having. What were those about? And what is it that kind of brought you to that point? Was it more stress, or something was pressurizing you, or what is it that drove the depression to take it to another level like that?
Yeah, I think the depression just got really, really bad. And I was actually in another abusive relationship with a partner, and I couldn't leave. I couldn't step out the outside of the house because I was so paranoid. And as I sat in that room for a period of months, I started to, like, my world started to open up. I started to see people who weren't alive, including my father, and I started to self-harm.
And was the abusive relationship that you got into, do you think that that was related to the fact that you had been abused by your father?
Yeah, I definitely think that was a trigger, because it was more of a controlling abuse, and also abuse in the way of like sexually forcing himself as well. So all of that brought back all of this stuff from my childhood, and then the fact that I couldn't keep work, and then the fact that I couldn't be with my children, and all these things pressing down on me at the same time really began to open up this wounding in a way that wasn't beneficial, because the voices that I started to hear and the visions that I saw were definitely negative. They weren't anything of light or positivity.
So you're starting to have these very scary negative experiences, and at the same time you describe it as an opening. So was it somehow an opening to another realm, a spiritual realm? Because I think that you have a framing of this that maybe is different than a lot of the trauma therapies would say, oh, these are symptoms of flashbacks and trauma, but you're sort of taking it a little bit differently, that it's negative, but at the same time it's also kind of an opening to other realms of reality. Is that right?
Yes, it definitely was an opening. Now that I look back on it in retrospect, at the time I didn't quite understand, but it was definitely an opening of these gifts that I had to see into other worlds. But at the time, it definitely felt very opposite than a gift. It was torture.
So we're going to come back to this, because in working with a lot of people who have what are called spiritual emergence or shamanic initiation or spiritual opening processes, this is really such the central issue. How do you sort out the negative and the positive? How do you sort out the trauma from the gift? So we're going to come back to this, because this is a really key piece of the whole question that we're exploring. And I also think it's really interesting and significant about what you say, that you weren't in a kind of like a manic so-called expanded state. You're in kind of this dark, paranoid place. You're really sort of disconnecting into these very negative energies. And some of the literature around spiritual emergence would kind of say, well, you know, these are the really psychotic people. They're not really having spiritual emergence, but actually you were, and you were able to navigate that. And so I think this is a very interesting question, how you took this negative seeming energy and then transformed it into the gifts. It sounds like the breaking point was really the suicide.
Yes, I know that was the turning point. And, you know, in shamanism, we call it the dark night of the soul. Being able to experience our darkness and get to a point, a very, very low point, so that we can emerge out and become something new.
How did you then get interested in traditional South African shamanism?
During that time, I had trained in pranayama, which is, you know, a form of yogic meditation. And I kept searching. You know, I would leave work and come home and research for hours about shamanism and healing and traditional ways of healing. And I was listening to a woman's blog talk radio show who was a traditional healer, a Sangoma. And she was so overjoyed on those radio shows. And I thought, wow, she's too happy. I could never, like, talk to her. But eventually I decided I was going to reach out to her. And I got what we call an ancestral divination. And it's actually a form of diagnosing a person's spiritual self. And so I was able to get a divination from her.
That's so great to hear that it was a podcast that was the turning point that connected you with shamanism.
Podcast changed life.
Okay, yes. So this is very far out from the perspective of psychiatry and the DSM. And tell us what you mean by ancestral divination.
Okay, so the ancestral reading, it is a tool that looks at the person's spiritual self and how their ancestors are doing in the spiritual realm and their guardians are doing in the spiritual realm. And as we like to say, as above, so below. So what is affecting us in the spirit form or in the spirit world will also trickle down in this physical form. And so we believe as Sangomas that a lot of our imbalances, or what people call, mental illness, things like that, or psychosis, may come from something that's happening in the spiritual realm. And I like to make this analogy, like when people go to the doctor and they sit in front of the doctor, they say, the doctor asks them a list of questions like, what's your father's history and what's your mother's history? And do you have cancer on this side or do you have this on that side? And it's the same thing with the ancestral divination, but the person sitting in front of us getting the consultation, they don't say anything about them. So we actually just get their name and their father's last name and their mother's last name. And then we go into a trance state to pull information from the spiritual realm and talk to the people about their ancestors. In African traditions, we believe that our ancestors are an essential part of how we work in this lifetime because we share their blood. So no difference from going to the doctor and saying, likely that I could get cancer because everybody on my mother's side had it, you know. And so we're looking at what your ancestors carried in their lifetimes and what needs to be cleansed in order for you to actually release those things ancestrally in your lineages so that you can have a more balanced life. And through initiation, we learn how to manage that and how to navigate into those spiritual forms so that we can be safe and that we can help people out of their own darkness.
Give us an example, like what was it that you were told and how did it make sense in terms of your own struggles and how was it useful to you and what did actually the divination say?
So I got the divination and by Yeye Gogo Nana, who was my teacher, and I had written down a list of questions of everything that I wanted to ask her. And before I even got to ask any questions, she actually answered all of my questions.
So she has these psychic or paranormal or spiritual abilities. She's a seer or a medium or a visionary. And what were some of the questions that you got answered?
Well, one of the questions is that I had written down is I knew that there was like an ancestor in my home, a spirit in my home that I was seeing, and I just wanted her to acknowledge or confirm or if she knew anything about it. And I had that question written down, and she said, you know, you have an energy in your home and it's your father and he did this to you. And she didn't know me from anyone else, you know, and she only asked me my name. So read my life from childhood to that present moment and was very detail oriented in everything that she described. And one of my last questions that I had written down is, was I supposed to have some sort of shamanic training or initiation? And at the end, she said, you know, you're supposed to be doing what I'm doing. You have a calling, a spiritual calling to become a priestess or a shaman. And, you know, from that point, I was just in tears because it so resonated with my spirit. And she was on point about everything that I experienced. And she, you know, when I first met her, she told me that I wasn't crazy. because, you know, from everybody else, you know, it looked like, or, you know, family and friends and being in the hospital, everybody was telling me that I was. And so she was the first person outside of the peer world that told me that I wasn't.
That goes a long way for building trust, telling a person that you're not crazy. Just for everybody out there listening, that's one of the key things that you need to be doing if you want to actually connect and relate to people. So you got this divination, which just really clicks. How did it help you?
Well, after the call, I felt completely liberated. I felt free and confirmed from everything that I was experiencing. So after a ancestral reading, there is that's the diagnostic tool that we use, but then there is a sort of prescription. So I had a prescription that I had to follow for 21 days and also to follow up with her for a healing session. And after the 21 days, I went to where she was for my first healing session.
I'm curious, what was the prescription that she gave you?
You know, I can't go into complete detail with all of it, but it's definitely some cleansing ritual and just things to follow each day for 21 days. One of them was no sugar, which I'm very big on.
So she's giving you a spiritual diagnosis, but then the treatment is a comprehensive, holistic approach that addresses your body and addresses the food that you eat as well as the spiritual dimension.
Yes, because it's all very connected. There's no separation.
Now, you say she was herself a survivor. Did she identify these so-called psychotic experiences that you were having that would have been seen as symptoms? Did she recognize that, okay, the paranoia and the voices that you had, did she see those as part of your gifts in terms of becoming a healer and a shaman yourself?
Yes, she absolutely saw those as my gifts, and she had expressed her experiences with depression and trauma and all those things, but definitely saw that my experiences were not just mental illness, that there was something happening that she could see in the spiritual realm for me that was different.
Can you tell us a little bit about that tradition? You say South Africa, and what is it from, and how does it connect to indigenous cultures there?
Absolutely. So the Nguni people of South Africa, their whole tribe of people that are medicine people there, and even today, over 70% of the population go to see traditional healers for their physical, emotional, psychological, and spiritual work. Traditional healers, sangomas, we use a form of trance dance, of drumming, of ceremonial and ritual work to help heal people from all kinds of ailments.
Tell us about your training. What is it that you needed to do to learn to be a shaman?
So the training involved a lot of things, and I went in very high energy because I felt like that this was going to be, it was a life or death matter for me. You know, looking back at it, I felt like I had a certain amount of resilience that, you know, maybe somebody with those kinds of experience wouldn't have had. There, it's a very difficult training. We are to humble ourselves to the earth, so we're always very close to the earth. And initiates go through a certain amount of rituals every day that they must do. There's lots of internal medicine that's taken. There's cleansing all of the time. And your dreams are what really gets you through to the next level. So you have certain dreams, and then your teacher knows that you're ready to go on to the next thing. So in my training, I was able to go into those trance states and learn how to navigate the spiritual world. And through that process, we had challenges where we had to find hidden objects, like someone visiting our house or the house where we were training at, or our teacher would have any object that she wanted, natural or man-made, and hide it somewhere outside or inside the house. And part of our training was to build our intuition and tell her exactly what the item was and where it was located. And then we'd had to run and go get it without hesitation and bring it back. And so you learn the aspect of finding missing items. You learn the sacred dances that help you heal and also help others heal. We initiate to certain nature spirits as well. So it's a long and arduous process for some people, but it really depends on your dedication to the process and what your how your dreams are happening.
There was something that you mentioned earlier about navigating. Tell us what that means. You say you go into trance, you learn to navigate these spirit realms. How is the navigation work? What are the skills there?
There are definitely specific skills, but I think what is the most helpful part of that is that the constant cleansing of my internal body and my spiritual body so that I could be stronger when I went to those places, because I was going to those places without being under initiation. So under initiation, you have this guardian, which is your teacher, to help you through. And so really going in and being able to connect with your divine spirits as your anchor, as your protection, and the medicine that is behind you was important. I'm unable to share exactly all the tools, like in the forms of navigating the trance experience, because that is part of initiation. But, you know, the essential part of this was having someone to teach me how to do that. So in that spiritual realm, I was able to meet my guardians, connect with them, and to have them be a force so that when I can come back into this physical form, I'd be able to hold their energy and the power.
Do you think that's one of the key things about how to differentiate or how to work with those negative energies, is connecting with your body? Because you mentioned before that sometimes people have these spiritual openings that get called mania, and they're a spiritual emergence process, but it's very positive and light. That wasn't what you went through. And what you went through was more negative, paranoia, frightening, self-harm, suicidal feelings. And what we often are hearing in the spiritual emergence kind of literature is that, well, those people aren't really the ones that are equipped. Those negative experiences aren't really part of spiritual emergence and spiritual awakening. That's really psychosis. But that's what you went through. So what was it that do you think makes the difference in terms of helping people with these negative experiences?
Yeah, you know, in shamanism, you have to go into the dark places in order to help to find your light. And to answer your question, yes, being grounded in a way and having myself come back into my body. So I talked a lot about trance, but there was definitely a lot of work about around grounding. But when I did get back into my body would shake, you know, or my head would turn different ways. And, you know, some people talk about the kundalini energy and how, you know, it can make an arm flail or move, you know, involuntary movements were happening during my Tuaza process, because I was just now getting back into my body and feeling it for the first time in a very long time. And so in my perspective, what was happening was that there were other energies that were attached in taking, kind of using my body in the form of self-harm and that sort of thing. So I had to reconnect to my body absolutely in order to connect to my divine self and my divine spirit. You know, we talk about the yin and yang, the dark and the light, and you have to go through the dark night of the soul in order to help people out of their own dark night. So I had to look within myself and see everything that was there and everything that I, you know, didn't want to face and that I was running away from my whole life, and facing it now with an armor of ancestral spirits behind me and medicine that was with me in order to become a warrior, so to speak.
Beautiful. Help us understand how the shamanic traditions kind of view evil and entities and spirits and that kind of thing.
Sure. You know, I can speak for Sangoma. We definitely have tools and rituals around removing negative entities. And as far as dealing with it on a personal level, you know, there were definitely some very dark things there, like I had mentioned before, but it was about me recognizing what we call, you know, the term used now is the shadow self. I am light, and I have a shadow, I have dark, and that is all a part of me. And I have love for every part of that. Out of the darkness becomes lots of beauty. There's a dynamic and two sides to everything, and being of acceptance of that, you know, even to this day, I'm still working on being acceptance of all the shadow parts of me. And the more that I love them, the more that they become less relevant in my life. So I'm really all about merging the two and acknowledging the fact that we are light workers. We work from light. That's the type of work that I do. And I'm also acknowledging that darkness, those dark energies, and yes, they are very present. And it is a force in our life. We see it every day. But how do we merge the two and balance the two so that what bothers us and hinders us and blocks us becomes less relevant through working on our fears?
I wanted to also ask you about the role of plant spirits. Plants are really important in shamanism. In a lot of the shamanic traditions, they use psychedelic plants, and that's part of the trance states that the shamans go into. But how is the tradition that you are part of, how do you relate to plant spirit medicines?
I work with plant medicines on a daily basis. I don't work with a lot of psychedelics, but there are psychedelics in our tradition. You know, we have a very light herb called impepo. Impepo is something that you would use kind of like sage here to clear the area or smudge your space. But we inhale the smoke to induce trance. So there is that component to the impepo. I mean, that's something that I would use on a daily basis, and it's very light. But there are over 2,000 medications in South Africa just focused on things dealing with the mind and madness. So there are so many earth medicines that are used, whether you're bathing with them, whether you're steaming with them, whether you drink them and then purge them. We have lots of different purging medicines. So plant medicines are a big part of my work, and I use them personally on a daily basis.
Ikaya, we don't have a lot of time, but I wanted to ask you one question more just about what kind of advice would you give to someone who maybe is a psychiatric survivor who's been through some really difficult experiences that would get called psychosis from a Western psychiatry perspective and is interested in shamanism and is wondering, well, maybe I have a shamanic calling, or maybe this is something that speaks to me. What advice or guidance would you have for them?
The advice I would have for them is to seek out a mentor and go reach out to somebody. The importance of somebody holding space and being able to consult with somebody is so important. It can be any shamanic tradition that you're called to. I think it's important to connect back to your own traditions, whether it be Celtic or Native or African.
Ikaya, we are just about out of time. Give us the web address of your website and how people can get in contact with you if they want to find out more about you and your work.
Sure. I have a practice here in Southern California, as you spoke of before. The website is sangomahealing.com. That's S-A-N-G-O-M-A healing.com.
Gogo Ikaya Essima, thank you so much for joining us today on Madness Radio.
Thank you so much, Will.
You've been listening to an interview with Gogo Ikaya Essima. Gogo Ikaya is a traditional healer, teacher, and psychiatric survivor. She's a shaman in the Sangoma tradition of South Africa, and she has a private practice based in Southern California. That's all the time we have on Madness Radio. Thanks for tuning in. You've been listening to Madness Radio, voices and visions from outside mental health. Madness Radio is sponsored by the Icarus Project and Portland Hearing Voices. Host is Will Hall, and producer is Nina Packabush. Madness Radio can be heard on KBOO-FM and the Pacifica Network, and shows are archived online at madnessradio.net.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with the requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open meeting policy is available by calling the station at 503-231-8032. Meetings will be held at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue in Portland. The Engineering Committee will meet on the first Wednesday at 7 p.m.
KBOO Portland.
And And now the KBOO News at Noon for Monday, October 2nd, 2017. Last night, more than 58 people were murdered and 515 more injured in the deadliest mass shooting in U.S. history after a gunman opened fire from the 32nd floor of a Las Vegas casino into the crowd attending a country music festival. The gunman, identified as the 64-year-old Stephen Paddock, killed himself as police entered his hotel room. The gunman indiscriminately fired for 10 minutes into the crowd with high-powered weapons. His motive for the shooting is, as of now, unclear. The Daesh ISIS terrorist group quickly claimed responsibility for the mass murder, but law enforcement officials have yet to find any contact between the 64-year-old white man and the terrorist group. In local news, a judge has ruled that a lawsuit against Monsanto filed by the city of Portland and the port of Portland can continue. The lawsuit against Monsanto asked for monetary compensation from the company for ongoing costs the city of Portland has expended to investigate, monitor, analyze, and clean up PCB contamination that occurred due to Monsanto activities along the Willamette River. The contamination is part of the reason the Portland Harbor was declared a Superfund site almost 20 years ago. Several years behind schedule, a cleanup plan was finally proposed last year. Eight other West Coast cities have also filed lawsuits against the chemical giant for its release of PCBs into the environment. Monsanto also has manufactured or currently manufactures Agent Orange, dioxin, DDT, Roundup, aspartame, bovine growth hormone, and is the world leader in the burgeoning GMO movement. While the judge allowed the lawsuit alleging U.S. Clean Water Act violations to continue, he also dismissed several other charges, including trespass and negligence. There are now active lawsuits for PCB contamination against Monsanto in Oregon, Washington, and California. And more local news. The recent Oregon legislature session cut more than $250,000 of funding.